Good evening. Every summer we have a sit like this. I always end up with a little spot right where my knee is. When it's hot, be hot. When it's cold, be cold. This is the first day of practice period, and I brought a handout. It's a rewrite of the one that Jane did last year. Or was it year before last? That I hope will be useful or a little bit inspiring for you all. It'll be 6 weeks and end on the last day of our session. It's always nice to end with a big bunch of sitting. Thank you. So you all know basically what it is, and I hope you find some way of making it really nourishing and helpful for you and your life. It's about life. In a way, nothing special. And yet, over and over, we need to wake up. And one hopes that this is a good way of doing it, not only in our own life, but with each other, that we help help each other, encourage each other to focus more clearly, be more present, and be more who we are. I thought I would be able to print out the Dogen translation that's online, and it's you have to get special permission. So I didn't realize that until today when I went to print out the first 10 chapters or so, and it said, no, you know, you have to ask. I wrote to the webmaster. I didn't know who else to write. And told him who I was, and told him why we wanted it. So it's still on its way. I'm assuming that they'll email me permission in some way. In the meantime, this book by Thomas Cleary is exactly the same thing with a slightly different translation. And as far as I can tell, there are more copious notes on the Soto online one. But otherwise, it's pretty much the same. So I don't know why we can't just pass this around, as we've been doing with Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, and read maybe read the first two. Some of them are very short and sort of simple. And some of them are very short and kind of profound. And then there are a few long ones in here also. So let's just have a taste of it tonight and see what you think. Oh, there are two copies. How nice. Okay, that's great. That's great. You can get these at Amazon. I don't know where else, but I know Amazon has it. Oh, sure.
So, book one, page one. So, there's six books. One day he said, in the continued biographies of eminent monks, it is reported that in the community of a certain meditation teacher, There was a monk who used a golden image of Buddha as well as a relic of Buddha in worship. Even in the communal dormitory, he always burned incense and prostrated himself before them, honoring and making offerings to them. Once the meditation teacher said to him, "The image and relic of the Buddha which you revere will eventually be wrong for you."
The monk did not agree. The teacher said, "This is the doing of evil spirits. You should quickly throw them away." As the monk departed in a rage, the teacher immediately shouted after him, "Open up the box and look." Though angry, the monk opened up the box. When he looked inside, he saw a poisonous serpent lying there, coiled up.
As I reflect upon this, although the images and relics of Buddha are the form and bones left behind by the Tathagata and should therefore be respected, nevertheless, if you think you can become enlightened just by worshipping them, this is a false view. It is a cause of becoming possessed by the poisonous snake of temptation.
Because the merit of the Buddha's teachings is something already established, they should be a blessing to men and gods just the same as a living Buddha. In general, it is true that if you honor and make offerings to the realms of the three jewels, faults will disappear and you will obtain merit. The action of evil dispositions will dissipate, and you will realize the fruit of humanity, or Godhead, as a result. But to think that you will thereby attain realization of the truth, this is a biased view, because one who is called a Buddhist follows the Buddhist teaching in order to arrive directly at the station of Buddhahood. You should simply meditate and discern the way in accordance with the teaching. The true activity which accords with the teaching is that which the monastery now has as its basis, sole occupation with sitting. You should reflect on this.
Why don't we talk about this a little bit before we go on to the next one? I saw in the paper the other day that there are relics of great teachers that are passing through Campbell and I think this weekend San Jose. Oh, you have it? Yeah. Sure, pass it around. Thomas Cleary says about them. They're called Sharita, purple crystals found in the cremation ashes of a Buddha. These were supposedly often found in the ashes of great Buddhists in China and Japan and enshrined in stupas. There's a great shrine in Sri Lanka that is dedicated to Buddha's tooth. Many battles have been fought over that. Tooth. The Buddha's tooth. As soon as Buddha was cremated, there became a very large argument about who got the ashes, who got what was left. And they tried real hard to be fair and divvied it all up so that there are bits and pieces in many different places. And that's still done today. Everywhere I go these days, I find a little monument to Koban. So he's up at Jikoji, and he's out at Hokoji, and he's over in Pureg, and he's also at Felsentor, and he's, where else? At Jikoji, at Hakubai in Boulder. He's back home in Japan. So it's a kind of convenience, I guess. It's a place of remembrance. we'll be having remembrance at the end of this month. He died on the 26th of July, so we'll... But what this is pointing out is that kind of worship of relics that he calls a temptation. I think he's talking about Mara, about that part of us that's always wanting extra, always wanting more and better. And what he says is that it's not a bad thing, and we're not going to go to hell because of it or anything terrible like that. He says we might, that all kinds of things can be achieved that way. Maybe life happiness can be achieved that way. But to think you will obtain realization of the truth this way is a mistake. It's a biased view. It's a sort of slant view instead of looking straight on. And he says the only way to look straight on is shikantaza. To sit up straight and be in place and simply be there. Not project out on something out there and make it special. So much of our work, I think, is just taking back our projections over and over again. Sometimes it feels like disappointment, but it's also refreshing. Oh, I made that up. I just thought that was true, or I wanted that to be true, but it's not. So it's always coming back and just facing clearly. Over and over, there's no end, because it keeps living us all the way through until it doesn't. Are there questions? Dan?
Why is it that even the simplest of things are not what we think they are, even though we've done them every day? I mean, even take something as simple as brushing your teeth. I mean, people have a pattern that they brush in, but every time it's different.
Yes.
And yet, we think, oh, I know how to do that. That's a no-brainer. But it's not a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, we know how to walk until we break our leg, and then we don't know how to walk anymore. It's like the fellow said to me, we're the temporarily abled. He said it from a wheelchair. So we just, of course we take things for granted. Otherwise we would be kind of addled, I think. But as a result of taking things for granted, we don't really see things as they are. Actually, even if we pay real close attention, we still don't really see things as they are. We come to the world with experience, and based on that experience, we read what happens to us, or we understand what happens to us.
So what does that mean in terms of practice? I mean, do we approach even the simplest of things like brushing our teeth as a practice?
We approach it as shikantaza, with the same mind, with no gaining idea, with all activity that way.
Brushing for no cavities is one that.
No, it's perfectly sensible to take care of our bodies and to appreciate our bodies and to live them fully. But to be very, and obviously you are aware that it's different every time you brush your teeth. It's kind of interesting.
It's interesting, and maybe this isn't a practice issue, is that that can be annoying. In other words, right, the fact that it's not the same, it's like, gee, even something that simple can be a no-brainer, that you have to be there.
Exactly. There's no such thing as a no-brainer.
My understanding is that there are other Buddhist traditions, schools or sects that do worship objects or the image of the Buddha or the Lotus Sutra.
Well, the Tibetan practice actually cultivates projection. It's part of the training. You do visualizations, which are projections. You imagine every different kind of really aspect of your own emotional life. The very peaceful, beautiful ones and the ferocious, outrageous ones. And learn to manage yourself in that way. And then eventually take them all back.
Oh, so it's more than eight, because I wasn't thinking it's the Tibetans as much as like Pure Land. I'm understanding that Pure Land is a lot more. The worshipping of an entity.
Yes, Amida.
Yes.
It's a worship of Amida Buddha, but it's there is an image in the church of Pure Land, but it's not worshipped in the way that he's talking about here. The image is not worshipped.
Because my understanding too, the Tibetans will use it as like a tool. And I think of it, I mean, I love things, though, so I've got to watch myself like that. The Buddha, or even the Mala, will remind
me. Yes.
As opposed as a thing to cultivate.
Right, and that's what he says. Chases away evil, is that what he says? Faults will disappear and you will obtain merit.
So I guess the question is that it's all traditions, as you know.
Yes.
It's all.
Yeah.
Not just certain traditions, not just our traditions.
I think the guy that wrote Dharma Punks, there's a statement that kind of struck me about the breath, like the whole idea of attention on the breath, which I would kind of compare to like attention on an object. You're kind of just focusing on,
yes,
on the breath. I mean, you still got to consider at one point you're not going to have that breath to focus on. So then what are you going to do? I think that's the warning of getting
attached to anything, yes.
Because you're not dealing with the whole impermanence of things. You're using those objects to prevent yourself from facing impermanence or accepting.
But if you pay attention to even to that kind of practice, you'll discover that it all by itself falls away. If you make the breath very much your focus, eventually you just won't be doing it anymore. You'll just be sitting. So, we're in charge for part of it, but a lot of it is just we're a process as well. in the early days after Buddha died, there were no statues of Buddha at all. He was not represented for hundreds of years, except as a wheel, as a Dharma wheel, or as a foot with the wheel in it, as walking in the world. I always wish they'd stuck with that, but then they got involved with the Greeks when Alexander came over and started making incredible statues. They made some before also, but it took a long time to break through that taboo. Dogen said, don't be afraid of a very large Buddha, and don't be superior if you meet a little bitty Buddha. He said, just meet all Buddhas with the same mind. I think that's how we go out into the world as Shikantaza people. Just meet what comes as it is, as Buddha. Then we don't have to be so particular about what it is. Should we go on to the next one? Or wait? There are 10 minutes. James got the book. Yeah.
He also said, just because disciplined behavior and vegetarian diet is to be maintained, yet if we therefore insist upon these as fundamental, establishing them as practice, and think that you can thereby attain the way, this is also wrong. It is just that this is the conduct of the patch-robed monks, the tradition of the sons of Buddha, and therefore we follow and practice it. Do not take this to be fundamental just because it is a good thing.
Somebody changed the setting from grilling to baking, please. Yet I do not mean to say that you should therefore violate precepts and be self-indulgent. To cling in such a manner is an erroneous view. It is that of an outsider. We just conform because it is the standard of the Buddhist family and the tradition of the meditation hall. As for making it into the fundamental concern, however, when I was staying in the temples of China, I never saw such a thing. For the purpose of the true attainment of the way, effort in the seated meditation alone is the standard of the Buddhists and patriarchs. For this reason, a fellow student of mine, Ojembo, who was a disciple of the Zen master Sai, taught me to abandon rigid adherence to vegetarianism and continual recitation of the perpetual scripture while it is in the meditation hall in China.
Iho asked, should the standards for study of the way in the monastery adhere to the pure rules of Pai Chang? If so, I see that he considered the accepting and maintenance of precepts as prerequisite. Also, I see that the transmitted tradition hands down the fundamental precepts. In the oral teaching and face-to-face transmission of our school as well, the precepts handed down from the West are given to students. These are the Bodhisattva precepts. However, in the preceptual scripture it says, recite this day and night. Why have us abandoned this recitation?
Dogen said, it is so. Students should certainly observe the regulations of Pai Chang. However, their form is the receiving of precepts, observance of precepts, sitting meditation, and so forth. it says to recite the preceptual scripture day and night and to wholeheartedly keep the precepts, it means that one should follow the practice of the ancients and concentrate only on sitting. When sitting in meditation, what precept is not maintained? What merit is not produced? The practices carried out by the ancients all had a profound intent. Without retaining your own subjective appreciation, you should follow the community and act in accord with the behavior of the ancients.
Ajo, the one who asked the question, is Dogen's chief disciple and the one that wrote down nearly everything that Dogen said. So he's actually writing this out, including his own question. And all through here, he kind of keeps Dogen going by asking cogent questions. And this one especially about the rules of the monastery. The rules, the Vinaya rules, are very long and complex, and were gathered, took years and years, 40 years of Buddha's practice. Every time something happened that was a question of morality or activity in Buddha's community, they would come to Buddha and decide what to do about it, what rule to make about it. And so over the years, this long, long, long list of rules was accumulated. And when Buddha was dying, they asked him which ones to keep, and he said, "You decide." And after he died, they couldn't decide. So they kept them all. And some of them, of course, aren't relevant, weren't even relevant then, I believe, very much. But we have them all now. And so some Buddhist schools keep every single one of those. If you're ordained, it means that you vowed to keep them all. And then there are the modified ones that the Chinese created for the Zen school, the Chan school, and then the Bodhisattva precepts that came from Bodhidharma, which is the most telling one because that's what we've inherited as Zen students, the Bodhisattva precepts. From Bodhidharma, there's an old koan, "Why did Bodhidharma come to the West?" Because the Dharma keeps traveling from Sri Lanka, where he started out, to China, to Korea and Japan, and now here. How does that happen? How can it be? And Dogen says, really, all of that is just about maintaining Zazen practice itself. That itself is the precepts. That's how we come to know the precepts, is through sitting.
That's profound trust.
Profound trust, yes. Yes. I wanted to say this is all about monastic practice, but as you can see already, it's really about ordinary us. The monastery has special vows. They take vows of staying in the monastery, one, and serving the Sangha by serving each other in the monastic situation, in community. We don't have it in the same way, but we, each of us, have a community that we serve and are served by. And the more we're aware of that, the more we're awake in our practice. The other rules for the monastery, most of them are just for the convenience of everybody living together in one place. It's sort of like having one person ring the bell so that we all know when to get up. But there are the precepts, and they're very carefully attended to in a monastery in a much more restricted way than we have in our own life. So we have much more license to eat what comes to us, hamburgers and bacon and things. It's much more of a choice for us. And so our restriction is really based on our own notion of what's wholesome and not harmful. Without license, he says, should not therefore violate precepts and be self-indulgent. So it's our continual challenge, and it's our koan, our everyday koan. How should we do this? What's too much? What's self-indulgent? What is actually something that we need? That keeps us awake also. Questions? Yeah.
This idea of indulgence and too much, he wasn't writing to us now, correct?
He was just talking to this little clutch of probably young men. Though Ajo wasn't so young, I think. He was... Yeah.
Did they imagine art?
I
don't... Backdraft for it all, where indulgence had control, you know, it's forced them. It's not only, it would be easier to listen to ourselves if we didn't have everyone else throwing it at us.
Yes.
And living in abundance.
Well, that's the luxury of living in a monastery, of course. There's not so much input. It becomes much more limited, much more simple. And in a way, it's just an enormous luxury not to have to deal with so much input. But on the other hand, people in a monastery end up having almost no ability to deal with the world. A lot of people at Zen Center have ended up having to come out eventually after 20 or 30 years, and they're having a really hard time because they don't have any street smarts, you know, don't know how to do. There's no way to measure, I think. It's just six of one and half a dozen of the other. And there are different times in our life. There are times when it helps very much to go to the monastery and simply drop everything and just be that for two or three years. But in the Zen tradition, you're not expected to stay in the monastery unless you want to stay and teach. But your practice then is meant to go out into the world and function in the world in some way. Koban's old master was a high school teacher. I think the man who inherited Koban's position, he was supposed to inherit the temple, and that man is a high school teacher also. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, a little bit of what the two was saying is that Ito, I believe, who reported this, wasn't he the one that he went to visit his mother? His mother said, I wanted you to really be, a monk. I didn't want you to dress up and, people wait on you. And I guess it shamed him or whatever. He left the monastery that he was at that time, I believe, and then went around to a couple others and eventually met with Dobie. And So it's relative. At that time, my understanding is that there still were people that had the riches and wanted more. I mean, they were the ones that were, I mean, they were the ones that, and that in fact, Dogen, my understanding is that's why he wanted to go back to the basics of cities by center.
Mm-hmm.
Because the temples were getting really fancy and getting powerful. It was all, I mean, the reading of it and about who could influence the who, you know. So I think it's all relative. We got you know, consumerism and we're here, but I guess it's always somebody's got more shells or rocks than somebody else. Was it Ijo that?
I don't know that story. I don't know that story of Ijo.
The one on the web.
I guess I would add that, like, I think that the human, like the mind, I mean, we could make something very ornate out of like a plum or something. Like the way the mind, like if it's not that, I'm thinking like what did these monks have what's the word, like to build off of? Like, the, I mean, obviously
yeah.
they had to, they know of this certain temptations because this is a big deal. They're writing about it. So people could make, you know, maybe find a pet ant or something. I mean,
yes.
And just kind of like put everything into that certain thing. I mean, and that's what it actually is. It doesn't matter. It's that action that festeringness keeps on building itself like a...
Yes, stirring, getting an excitement, extra excitement out of things. That's why the Quakers are that way too. And the Quakers I've always admired because there's always that temptation to build up and create a hierarchy and create fancier and fancier ways of being. And then in the Quaker tradition, because there's no real leadership, it doesn't work very well, that tendency. And so they just keep returning to simplicity over and over again. They go through all kinds of things, but almost invariably it returns to a kind of simplicity that I always think the 12-step program is the same way, because that again just keeps coming back to the same, just community, basically starting over in community, so that the communal aspect is the foundation of it, rather than expertise or
sitting up close to the kingdom.
Yeah, who gets to sit close to the fan? Well, okay, it's after 8:00.